You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have a three-time, I think. Is this your third?
This is my third.
All right. Miss Stephanie Crawford is back to talk about some horror movies with me. Thank you for coming back, Stephanie.
Yeah, of course. I'm just sorry I'm not Elric.
Okay.
And so are your listeners.
I think they're fine. I think they're good. Everybody loves you and loves your podcasting abilities, and I am certainly among your fans, so I'm glad to have you. We are going to do a couple Larry Cohen movies and then another movie that doesn't really have to do with Larry Cohen at all. But as we have been doing, I like to start with the weird stuff. So we're going to start with Full Moon High from 1981.
Have I got a short lifeline or what?
You carry the curse of the pentagram.
I've always wanted to go to the Pentagon.
Pentagram, stupid.
Oh, what shape is that?
The mark of the wolf.
Worse than having the mark of the wolf, Tony discovered, he was the wolf.
Look, I got some dreaded disease only whispered about in the Dark Ages, okay?
Is that all? A little penicillin will clear it up just like that.
Oh, no.
It can't be that severe. I mean, you're running better than ever.
Eating better than ever was more like it.
Never again. I'll never do it again.
But whenever the moon was full, he did do it again and again and again.
Oh, God, what a bummer.
So now, what's your... Okay. I guess I should explain what the movie's about. You know what? I can't explain. Can you explain what the movie's about?
You can.
I mean, I can try, but I was perplexed by it. This is my first time watching it. I mean, I think you've seen it a couple times, so maybe you can explain the plot a little better. I just enjoy when you explain plots better than I do.
It's funny. I think I've seen this movie about three times now, and I think it confounds me a little bit more each time I see it.
Really?
Yeah, it's what in the business, what insiders call a goofer.
All right,
I have just made that up. But
I like it.
Yes, we have your all-American high school student, who's played by Adam Arkin.
Oh, Adam Arkin.
Father is Ed McMahon, well,
yes.
Of course.
Naturally.
And I think they travel together to Romania, and the dad's a little bit of a J. Edgar Hoover character, and he's there on some shady business, and his son's kind of tagging along. And when he's out for the night, he gets bitten by a werewolf. And thankfully, his charm seems to seep over into his werewolf being, because he just kind of annoys everybody, just kind of nips your butt, and he goes on his merry way. And time passes, and he hits an age where he returns to his high school, Full Moon High, and he wants to give high school another try. You know, becoming a werewolf kind of ruined it for him. So he poses as his own son to try to recapture and make things right in his high school career.
Yeah, there you go. That's pretty much it. That's kind of it. Yeah, it's a weird one because of the two time periods, which very much perplexed me. Although I did enjoy the time passage montage, which is basically a hand switching out pictures of different presidents.
Hey.
As opposed to flipping through the pages of a calendar.
Very
you get to
economical.
See... Yeah, no, it was great.
And patriotic.
But then there's like some headlines that show where he's going, like... talking about him nipping people and biting people in all over Europe, I guess.
Yeah, werewolf annoys community is one.
What's that? That's a good one.
Direct quote.
That is good. I like it. Yeah. But so yeah, I had to like go back a couple times to figure out like when he came back to the high school, because the high school, they show it a little bit at the beginning and you get to see his classmates played by like Bill Kirchenbauer. Isn't he the, he's the just one, just the 10 of us dad, I think.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I think
he's I was trying to place that.
Yeah, so he's in there, and then there's a couple others. Roz Kelly, maybe, is she one of the, yeah, she's, yeah, yeah, yeah. So like she's in the, like, I don't know, 1960s version. I forget if they give the year, because it seems like he was gone for many, many years.
Well, they do the duck and cover under the desk.
Oh, so it's like Cuban Missile Crisis, maybe 60s.
Yeah, then, and okay. Ed McMahon's constantly talking about commies and Bolsheviks. So
the commies turned my son into a wolf. I don't know how they did it. Might have been something in the water.
Okay, so Larry does his due diligence in setting the stage. But it's really distracting because Bill Kirchenbauer wears this horrible wig because he's, you know, a notoriously bald actor. And at first I was like, oh, is this like a really early role for him? Boy, that hair is really really distracting.
It's so lush.
It is quite lush. It's, you know, a veritable forest. And he then, of course, when we see him in the new incarnation of the school, which is really alarming because it's gone from, like, you know, sort of picturesque all-American high school to this, like, demilitarized zone or something. It's just like, you know, there's homeless guys on the steps of the school. There's people pissing in the drinking fountain and fighting in the hallways. And it's alarming, the difference between Full Moon High in the 60s and the 80s.
Yeah, I recently watched Class of 1984 and 1999. I was like, yep, this is I've completed the trilogy of terrible schools.
Totally. It really does feel like he's taking a page out of like one of those schools. It's like that, but there's like comedy around it all, but I don't know. It's very strange.
Well, yeah, it's not quite trauma level, like Class of Newcomb High, but
no.
I guess it's like a G-rated version of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. It's just enough to make it feel like slightly creepy and menacing, but they don't remind you of it outside of, you know, just basically the first time he comes back, really, for the most part. But what's nice about him coming back is that then we get to see Joanne Nail at about 36 minutes in. She shows up at like a high school dance, and then she sort of becomes, you know, I guess the love interest, kind of. But there's a great scene in the gym where, you know, Adam Arkin turns into the werewolf and some guy sees him, and then he runs back to the gym and tries to tell Joanne Nail about it. But she thinks he's trying to do some kind of new wave dance. And so she ends up turning it into like this werewolf dance, which totally reminded me of the Teen Wolf dance that happens.
Yeah.
And this movie's like 4 years before Teen Wolf. So Larry got there first with the Teen Wolf dance.
That's right. No, it's one of those great movie logic ones where you're like, just yell over the music that someone's being attacked. No, just keep repeating the werewolf move. Someone has to figure this out.
Yeah, I give Larry Cohen some credit because I feel like he's got some old school roots in some respects. Like, I don't want to go too far with this, but like maybe there's some silent comedy goofiness that I'm sure he was a fan of when he was a kid that he's sort of trying to carry over, maybe. I don't know.
Well, because I'm kind of would be skipping over to another movie we're talking about. But he talked about when he was younger, he wanted to work for Red Buttons.
Oh, interesting.
I agree with you. And he mentioned that he feels that all of his movies have some degree of comedy. And so when they're like, no, just do a straight, complete comedy, he had like decades of influences that he just kind of, he really unleashed it in Full Moon High.
So is this stuff was this on the commentary for this disc that he was giving some of that away?
Yes, this and The Ambulance.
Interesting. I didn't get a chance to listen to The Ambulance. I listened to some of this commentary. And I like Larry Cohen a lot, and I like to hear him talk about his process and his influences. And this movie this movie just perplexed me, though, because it has such an odd structure that is almost like a fuck you three acts. I mean, it's kind of got three acts, but it's just so strange. Did he talk about like how this got, like where did this come from? Like, I'm just fascinated by this idea.
Yeah, he pretty much said people kept telling him that he was so funny, he should just try to make a straight comedy.
Oh.
And I think that's kind of his strength, I think, is like when he's not going for that, when he has like a strong plot he really believes in, and his natural humor comes into that. This does feel like Gag's first character, plot, structure, everything else a distant second.
Yeah, I agree. And it doesn't help the movie that, and I'm not going to go too deep into this, but for me, Adam Arkin is not a strong lead. I'm not a big Adam Arkin fan. I don't know how you feel about him. You're a fan? You think he's all right?
I can't really say I've gone through life as an Adam Arkin fan.
Yeah.
I remember him on some TV show. I think he's a doctor.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now I can't remember what that was. I have to look that up.
Chicago Hope. My mom was really into Chicago Hope.
There you go.
Well, I think he's very natural. He has a very sweet demeanor. But you're right. It's almost such, it's like a really low key, like sardonic way of delivering the lines.
I'll go so far as to call it no key.
How about no that? Key.
It's really low key.
He sat down at the piano. He's like, yeah, I'm good.
Nothing. Yeah, I have I mentioned this on a Pure Cinema Patreon episode when we were talking about this movie. I have a problem with his mouth. He's got an oddly shaped mouth that reminds me of a cartoon character, specifically a Flintstones character. And so when I see him move his mouth, I feel like he's flapping his mouth like Barney Rubble or something. And it's incredibly distracting to me. And so I can barely watch him in movies.
I think I could kind of see that, kind of like the small lipped kind of pointed mouth
exactly.
kind of thing.
You're seeing it.
It seems to work well with fangs, though. Maybe he didn't mention on the commentary, but maybe he's like, you know, if you can put like a full big denture of fangs in a mouth, that's the actor for you.
You know what? That's totally funny, because now that I think about it, when he was in the werewolf mode, I was suddenly not bothered by his mouth anymore, although he wasn't really talking too much. But even just looking at the picture on the back, I'm like, no, that actually really works.
Yeah.
But yeah, outside of that, no.
So what did you think of the amazing werewolf effects and makeup in this?
You know, it's obviously not, it's not a Rick Baker kind of thing we're having here. So it felt to me, again, like him throwing back to a little bit of Universal Horror, a little bit of Lon Chaney, maybe, you know, with a little bit of like the present day 80s thrown in. But it definitely feels more like a classic werewolf than a quote unquote modern 80s werewolf, which I was fine with, because I didn't feel like the movie was leaning too hard on like, he's got to look really real, you know, in that way that the other werewolf movies in 1980. It's so funny. I didn't think about the context of this coming out in 1981 with The Howling and American Werewolf having come out the same year. And it's just like the difference between people that are like, well, I want to see a really great transformation. I'm going to pull me high.
I'm going to look at these three choices here. Full Moon High. It's Larry Cohen knows his horror.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's no. So I was fine with it, you know. But I don't know. It's just it. Like I said, it's just an odd movie. It definitely fits the sort of cult movie mold because of the gags and the weird structure and yeah, just the cast. I mean, Ed McMahon was not in that many movies. Like he's in this movie. He's in a movie called Slaughter's Big Ripoff, which is one of the sequels to the Slaughter movies with Jim Brown, and he plays like a mob boss in that, which I highly recommend. It's a really crazy movie, and some guy, I can't remember if Ed McMahon gets killed with airplane glue or if somebody else gets attacked with airplane glue, but that's definitely a plot point in Slaughter's Big Ripoff. I digress. He is fun to watch in this, and the movie went up like a full half star when Adam Arkin's dad, Alan Arkin, shows up in the last 20 minutes as like this, is he a psychologist or whatever?
Something like that.
I remember
he's like a detective psychologist something.
Yeah. I just remember he's being introduced as like this guy is about to jump off a ledge, and he starts like telling the guy like, yeah, go ahead and do it. And the two cops down on the ground, or a cop and a fireman, are talking to each other, and they're like,
he belongs to the ridicule and insult school of psychiatry. He shames him down.
What are you, deaf to? Take a hop, take a walk, take a ride, take a fall. Can I get another doctor, please?
Nah, you don't deserve anybody better than me. You want to kill yourself? Do yourself a favor. Something constructive. Get a job in a nuclear power plant. Do it quick. I got an appointment at 2 o'clock.
Doc, do me a favor. The guy is going to jump off the roof.
So what? Probably nobody will come to the funeral anyway. Oh, 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 the ledge is collapsing. Aha! I made you look. Shame on you. You baby? I bet you were a pansy in school.
You're just like my father! I'll kill you!
And I'm like, okay, that's an interesting thing. And then, you know, just as he... I don't know if he's trying to do like a Groucho Marx or something. I feel like he's kind of doing a bit. Or maybe he's just being kind of slightly grumpy Alan Arkin.
Tony, this is the famous Dr. Brand.
Hello?
So, you turn into a wolf.
Who cares? You think you're the only werewolf? Eastern Europe is full of your kind, and if we wanted more werewolves in this country, we would send for them.
Are you sure this is the right man?
You expected somebody to kiss your ass, didn't you, Big Shot? What's so great about taking a step backwards in evolution? I'd like to see a wolf turn into a man. That would be progress. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Doug, I'm getting that odd feeling.
Oh, yes? Would you like to describe it to me?
Well, you know in the cartoons when the mouse reaches down into the cat and turns him inside out?
Hold on. Hold on. Let's get all this great dialogue down on tape. This is Dr. Brand speaking. Thank you. Thank you. Hold the applause.
Testing. 1, 2, 3. Testing.
Excuse me. Would you mind not talking when I am, please? It muddies up the tape. Thank you.
But he's super funny the whole way through the last 20 minutes of the movie. And I don't want to say he gives the movie structure, but when he's there, I'm just like, oh, I just totally relax. I'm like, oh, Alan Arkin's here. I don't even care what we're doing now. You know,
it's finally great. I'm in the hands of the right Arkin.
Exactly. The proper Arkin. Yeah, so that's good. But yeah, I don't know. I was like I said, I was really perplexed by the plot and then the time jump and everything. But I guess I kind of like it when a movie perplexes me in a certain way, because the more I think about it, while I was watching it, I was kind of annoyed by Adam Arkin, certainly, but also just by the weird structure. But the more I think about it, the more I'm like, no, that was kind of interesting. And the gags, there's some interesting gags. There's definitely a lot that fall flat. But I don't know. I like seeing Jim J. Bullock as the child of the Just the Ten of Us dad guy. And Jim J. Bullock, who I used to see.
Yeah. A small but really cool little role.
It's a weird role when you have a son that's like clearly not that much younger than you, but it's just the idea of throwing a bunch of comedic actors together kind of in a soup. So I don't know. I kind of dug that. But and Joanne Neal is super cute in this. Like,
well, of course.
I mean, but like I almost like it was weird because this is years after Switchblade Sisters. I mean, not that. I want to say that's like 75 or something. So this is like 6 years after that, and I almost feel like she's cuter in this, and maybe it's just because she's not pissed off and grumpy all the time like she is in Switchblade Sisters, but I like her in that too.
Well, because she's a vegetarian in this one, and that's one of my favorite lines when he's talking to her. He's like, I feel vegetarians are trustworthy.
I totally forgot that she's like this, like... quasi hippie type character. That's
yeah,
pretty cool.
It's true. It is after The Visitor, and she seems like 10 years older in The Visitor than
that's right. There's a weird time warp, but you know, that movie, I could see that movie affecting all the folks involved in that way, you know.
Yeah, no, that's like going through a black hole.
Craziness.
I'd imagine.
What a run. Switchblade Sisters, The Visitor, and Full Moon High. Something
the
else.
Holy Trinity of Joanne Neal.
What else? So it just has the commentary, but you found it pretty satisfying, this commentary, then, overall, I'd say.
Yeah. Again, I keep skipping ahead to the ambulance. That is a very active commentary. This one, there were some dead spaces.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but no, it was really great listening to, and I didn't even notice that Bob Saget was in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's like, oh, this is Bob Saget's first role. He always tells everyone I'm the one who got him his SAG card.
Aww,
so, you know, you get like little tidbits like that. That was always fun. Cool.
Yeah, I did notice him. He shows up, I think, in the original high school, the 60s version of Full Moon High. And then later, I forget what he's doing. He's like more
he's
official.
The sportscaster. They give him like a gray wig.
Yeah, the aging up of some of the characters is just so clearly, yeah, whatever, you know, that I kind of like that.
Well, like with Roz Kelly, like all they really did was when she was a teenager, they put her in pigtails and no makeup.
Yep.
And then they like, okay, low cut dress, sultry.
Yeah, I just, like I said, I love that there was a time when you could just do that. Like if you, I just don't feel like, maybe there's a certain kind of way that you could do it now where you're just absolutely playing it as a total joke. But I don't even feel like movies like this get made at all anymore. Not, it's not like a scary movie kind of, you know, spoofy comedy. It's something else. It's not quite Airplane-ish. I don't know. It's somewhere in between there. And it's not the kind of film that got made much at all, but certainly not now, I don't think.
Right. It seems like we're having a little bit of a renaissance with horror comedies,
mm-hmm.
or even just, like dark comedy horror movies, but they always seem cool and really self-knowing. And this one is so innocent in how ridiculous and stupid it lets itself look. It is not self-conscious at all.
Which I actually kind of love. I think that's the thing.
It's a huge part of its charm, in my
right.
opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that's the thing that I keep thinking about the more time I have away from it. It's just kind of like, oh, that was just a cute little movie. Why was I so annoyed with that thing? It, you know, it didn't it didn't mean me any harm. It was just kind of trying to be goofy.
Just
you know?
Don't focus on Adam's mouth so much.
I got to really work on that. I got to work on that. All right, well, let's move on to the better of the two Larry Cohen movies here. And not to, you know, besmirch Full Moon High too much, but I'm pretty sure most people that if they watch both of these movies close together will probably agree that The Ambulance is pretty awesome.
A killer is loose in New York City.
Somebody call an ambulance, okay?
Will you look at this computer printout? All on missing persons reports in the last 2 weeks.
This is for Lieutenant.
What exactly do you think happened?
I don't know.
Did you do something to that girl yourself? Are you one of those psychopaths who kills girls and goes to the police to tell stories?
I don't know anything about the dead woman in the park, okay?
I was just trying to get away from that.
Now, one man has to find the truth.
They're gonna kill me!
An ambulance that picks up New Yorkers and they're never seen or heard from again. A vehicle of mercy that's really a murder machine.
What do you think of it?
I think it's pretty awesome.
Nice.
And it's funny, the first time I saw both of these movies was a few years ago. I only had antenna TV, and there's this free movie channel. I wish I could remember the name of it, but they would show the most random things. And both of these movies were playing at different times, and I would just land in the middle of them. And wow. It reminded me of being a kid because I was trying to figure out what the hell they were showing with no context. And when it comes to The Ambulance and Full Moon High, that was a challenge.
I could only imagine. I forgot to mention real quick, my story with Full Moon High is that when I moved to LA, I went on a run of, I was still collecting VHS at the time. This was like 1999. And I went to a couple 2020 videos, which is a chain that I don't know if they're nationwide or not. I don't think they're active anymore, but they would have these shelves full of, you know, movies to buy. And I came across a copy of Full Moon High, and I was so excited by it because it was Larry Cohen and it looked like a cult movie. And I, you know, was and am a big Teen Wolf fan. I'm like, oh, this is totally going to be my jam. Bought the VHS tape, never watched it. You know, here we are 19 years later, and I finally watched it on this Blu-ray, but I never watched that tape.
Oh, wow. So this Blu-ray was your first time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I may have caught part of it on cable here or there, but never did I ever sit through the whole thing until this. So, but yeah, anyway, that's cool that you came across both these movies on that weird channel. They must have had some kind of Larry Cohen package deal.
I guess. Probably, because when Annette Funicello died, they did like this great marathon of her beach movies. So
they're all MGM. That's what it is. This movie, that.
Okay.
So is it probably an MGM?
Yeah, they
package?
Probably have a deal.
That's
okay.
Cool. I like those movies. I really hope that they get some kind of a Blu-ray set at some. I mean, a couple of them had come out through Olive Films, but not enough. I need more.
Yeah, I have them all on DVD, but yeah, it would be great. I had to pay more than I want to for Back to the Beach, too. But
oh, look, honey! It's our old beach!
Dude, it's totally
Shuttle are going back to the beach.
You're not a surfer anymore. You live in Ohio.
Oh, that's not
a Larry Cohen movie. I don't know why I'm talking about that.
No. I like Back to the Beach, but I was just bummed that's not on Blu-ray yet. That drives me crazy. That movie needs to be on Blu-ray.
Well, you're very influential with the Blu-ray people, so
I'm
glad you said that.
I'll pull some favors to get that one on Blu-ray. So this plot I can't explain. The ambulance is a really interesting one of Larry's better sort of ideas for a movie, I think. And the basic plot of it is that Eric Roberts plays an illustrator for Marvel Comics. And he works with Stan Lee, which is really cool because Stan Lee's in the movie as his boss.
In the movie.
Yeah.
Giving him a hard time.
Lose something, Josh? Her.
Wow, that's some loss.
Yeah, she's actually a lot better looking than this.
Yeah, I'm sure she is. But I want to ask you something, Josh. Huh. Are you planning to do any work this morning?
Ah, what's the use, Stan? Every female character I draw ends up looking like her. Look at that.
Yeah, I've noticed that. In fact, I think it's something we ought to talk about, but not here. Come on, let's talk over here, Josh. Your drawings have been all looking pretty much alike. You know, Josh, when I gave you that Dr. Strong strip to do, I thought you'd realize what an opportunity it was.
I do, Stan.
I know, but, you know, I don't want to see you blow it on a kind of a girl.
Stan, have I ever let you down?
No.
Nights, weekends, whatever you needed. Look, I traded in my whole goddamn life for this comic strip. Look,
you've got to work out your own problems on your own time, okay? You do what you have to do, and I'll do what I have to do.
Yeah, which is awesome. It's like just a notch above, you know, a Marvel cameo, but it's sort of like the predecessor to the Marvel cameos because he is, you know, like you said, giving him a hard time about not getting any work done. But the idea is that he basically sees this woman on the street. I guess he's seen her. It's in New York. He's seen her a few times and one day decides he's going to approach her. He's been stalking her and now he's going to accost her.
Excuse me. I'm with the U.S. Census Bureau and I must ask you a question. Are you married or in love?
And I need to be left alone. Go away.
That's direct. You know, I knew you'd be direct the first time I saw you, which is when, you might ask. Well, every day at lunchtime. I always see you out here, and I always try to catch up with you to say hello.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
And every day, I always lose you in the crowd.
You give me a 30-second head start, you can lose me again.
Look out. You almost got run over.
I did not. I'm perfectly capable of crossing the street all on myself.
Face it, I just saved your life, and therefore, I'm responsible for your life, at least until after lunch, so grab an arm.
I have met creepier guys than you. I just can't recall when.
I knew you'd be charming. You can call me Joshua.
And so, of course, she responds relatively bristly. She's kind of like, basically, get the hell away from me. And then he tries to buy her like a Walkman and like a cheap bracelet off a street vendor. And she's, you know, kind of nice about it, but still more like, really, though, fuck off. And he stays with her. And then suddenly she starts to get sick and she collapses. And he says to somebody, you know, call an ambulance. Then an ambulance shows up and takes her away. And he doesn't know her name yet. He gets her first name, but he doesn't get her last name. And then he asks the ambulance drivers what hospital she'll be taken to. And he says, oh, I'll come see you later. At this hospital, he goes to see her. She's not there. You come to find out that the ambulance is owned by this scientist doctor dude who's doing some weird experiments and kidnapping people off the street. And it's this whole conspiracy thing. And it's very difficult for Eric Roberts to convince people that it's happening. James Earl Jones is having none of it. And I do like James Earl Jones. I don't know. It always feels like he's slumming it whenever he shows up in a movie, but he's clearly having a good time, you know, as this cop.
Right. Like he's almost too good to do anything. You want to see him in everything, but he's too good for everything.
He's too good. I mean, the voice of Darth Vader, you're always just like, dude, this is not Darth Vader. This is a big step down from that, you know? So, but I love his voice and I love his manner and he's kind of grumpy and weird in this one. Yeah, so I don't know. So there's that whole business of trying to convince people, oh, this is happening, and having trouble convincing people, and then finally convincing another cop that it's happening, and sort of going through the machinations of conspiracy plot. And I don't want to give away the whole movie, but that's sort of the wheels in motion of the story. But I like the plot of it. I think it's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, no, I love the plot. It's really unique for a thriller called The Ambulance. You could assume it's pretty hokey, but it's such a fun ride. And I like all the little details. There's a lot of thought put into the script. Like, she's diabetic. She, like, after she collapses, she says, "I'm diabetic." And that becomes a big plot point in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was really, really interesting, too.
Yeah. No, it's fun. There's so many stunts and action scenes in this, but the script is kind of perfect, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Larry's a great writer, and I think it's among the best stuff he ever did. It's great. It's a really great movie, and I was just really psyched to see. Well, I love seeing Scream Factory kind of going whole hog into, I mean, they've been doing Larry Cohen stuff for years, but this year we're getting Full Moon High, The Ambulance, It's Alive. I mean, it's a nice, robust Larry kind of year.
Yeah, and I think the King Cohen documentary coming out is great timing with that. The director of that documentary moderates both of these commentaries.
He seems like a good dude.
He does, yeah. He lets Larry talk. He guides them a little bit, but otherwise he lets them talk.
That's smart, because Larry is one of those guys you can tell just has tons of stories and doesn't necessarily, like, I feel like he's like a little humble about it. Like, I don't think he necessarily will go into stories at the drop of a hat, but I think with proper coaxing and sort of setup, he'll start going. And just hearing just all the stories about him making films in New York in the 1970s, and how run and gun he was. I mean, I don't know that this movie is totally that way, although it feels like there's definitely a little bit of run and gun in it. But
a little bit, but he did say it was one of the first movies he did where, like, he didn't have to worry about doing the payroll and everything at the end of the day.
Oh, wow.
He had, like, other people do that for him. So he's like, I could just focus on directing, and it was nice.
That's funny. And then it turns out to be one of his best movies, so that's really interesting. I could see how dealing with payroll could distract you creatively a little bit.
Can you imagine? You write the script, you produce it, you direct it, and then you're like, all right, let's write some checks. Oh, man.
That's crazy. That's so funny. This is 1990. Larry Cohen's making movies from the early set. This is almost like 20 years into his career, and it's the first movie he's not doing the payroll. That is truly an American independent right there.
Yeah, it's a weird business if you sit down and think about it.
What do you think of Eric Roberts? What are your Eric Roberts feelings?
In this movie specifically.
Sure, but in general
I also. I have to. Well, it's interesting because, I'm sorry to trip up a little here. I don't want to be like weird or insensitive, but there are some tics in his performance that I could tell he was dealing with drugs.
Oh, really?
Like cocaine. And it's just, there's certain things in his performances.
Anything specific?
Well, it's just, it works with the character because he's running throughout New York City and he's manic.
Yeah.
He's this really sweet, almost like fatally optimistic character in this, because he gets beaten down so hard in this movie.
He does.
And he keeps getting backed up. He's got to save the girl, you know. Oh, horses almost trampled me. That's okay. Let's keep on going. But there's almost this, I don't know, like underlying kind of darkness to like how unrelenting, like if you told me he didn't sleep at all during the filming of this, I would believe you.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. There is something about the manic energy that you could, and I think the part of the reason I don't immediately think of it is because it does surprisingly pair with the character pretty well, because he's literally going out of his mind and freaking out and paranoid and all these things. So, you know, if he is having those problems, and I can kind of see a little bit of the seams now that you mention it, it's masked pretty well by the character, you know?
Right. It is a very unique character because he's not a self-assured action star, and he's not like a guy who's like beaten down by the world. He's a really sweet guy. He jokes with Red Button's character, who he meets in a hospital, and I think they have wonderful chemistry together.
Why don't you make me feel better and just confess?
Make you feel better?
Yeah, tell me all the grisly little details about where the parts of the body are buried. I mean, after all, I'm a nice guy. I could use the story. To me, it would mean a lot. I mean, let's face it, kid. Look, at my age, they're trying to put me out to pasture. The report sent down by those son-of-a-bitch doctors didn't sit too well with that New York Post city editor, who already had put me on obituaries, hoping that one day soon I would write my own.
Are you trying to tell me that you're a newspaper reporter?
The best.
I could give you a headline, but they never print it.
Well, try me.
Okay. An ambulance.
An ambulance.
It picks up New Yorkers. And they're never seen or heard from again. A vehicle of mercy that's really a murder machine.
I like the one about the homicidal slasher much better. It always sells papers. Look, why don't we stick to that?
Okay, fuck you, and get off my bed.
I love the scenes. They're so funny together. And he's great with James Earl Jones. He's pretty much great with everyone. Mm-hmm. He's like a very cheerful, funny character that just wants people to listen to him.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is nobody listens to anyone in this movie. There's a scene where a woman cop is calling in the police station. She's like, I need help. I'm in trouble here. And he's like, ah, you again. Forget it. He hangs up the phone, and Eric Roberts has to convince him to go in and give an officer backup. And that's kind of a running theme. Like, those guys are killers. Get out of here. We're looking at a corpse right now. I don't know why you're bothering us talking about killers.
Yeah, like
that was my New York accent.
That was pretty great, actually. I felt like I was in Times Square in 1978 right there.
Yeah.
But the cops are that great sort of seen it all, sick of it, grumpy New York cops. Like the scene where he almost gets trampled by horses, the ambulance comes flying out of this building and almost runs him over, and then these horses come flying out and he tries to tell the cops, and they're like, the kids, you know, rip the doors off of that place every other week.
They always run those horses out into New York City, you know how it is.
And I'm just like, what? Oh my God. Yeah, that's pretty great. Just his interactions with the cops, quite entertaining, I must say. But yeah, it's really, I like the way that it escalates and then has a couple, I don't want to say it has like double-decker endings, but it has a thing where you're like, oh, everything's good. Nope, it's not good. Oh, is it not going to be good again? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Kind of that sort of feeling. And I kind of like, sometimes I get annoyed if they do it too much, right. But I feel like he did it just the right amount. That I was like, okay, that was good. I like that.
Yeah, it was done really well here. You get like a really kick-ass stunt and then some more cute humor. So
yeah.
I was
yeah.
a fan.
Well, very cool. Yeah, this one I definitely recommend for Larry Cohen fans. And I feel like it's probably one of the lesser seen Cohen movies because I don't think there was even a made-on-demand DVD until, I want to say like, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but I'm totally pulling that on my ass. I really don't know when the Made on Demand disc came out, but I feel like it wasn't available outside of VHS for a long time, whereas a lot of his other stuff, at least Anchor Bay, picked up, you know, Cue the Winged Serpent and The Stuff and like all
right.
these.
Right. Those are the ones I'd see in ads in Fangoria, but never the ambulance.
Yeah. No, I totally got passed over. So I don't know. I think it's a great, I mean, it's, you can call it horror, but it's more thriller, paranoid thriller with like a little horror at the edges in terms of some of the heightened motivations of the doctor character and what have you. But so maybe that's why it didn't fully get embraced by the horror community and thus didn't get a release at some point outside of that made-on-demand DVD. So I was super psyched when Scream put this out. And like I said, let there be more Larry Cohen. this year beyond the It's Alive trilogy.
Please, it would be great to have more extras, but I think the commentaries are really well done. And yeah, just seeing these look great and be an affordable price is wonderful. Because I remember trying to look up the ambulance on DVD, and it was like a ridiculous price.
Oh, was
just
it?
Just for the DVD, yeah.
Lame. All right, so after your Coen Fest, you can, or not, move on to our next movie, which is Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon from 2006.
The boy murdered Silas, buried his body in the field, and dragged Molly from the house, hanging her in the farm's apple orchard.
You have no idea how much cardio I have to do. It's ridiculous. There's that whole thing of making it look like you're walking, and everybody else is running their asses off.
Everybody thinks we just wake up one morning and start obsessing about a girl and start stalking her, killing everybody that gets in the way.
That does seem to happen a lot with you guys.
That boy, he's going to be the best yet.
There are 11 exits from the first floor. Another 8 or 9 that might be manageable from the second floor. All the obvious weapons, I sabotaged.
Why are you doing this?
We're not going to have this conversation.
Oh, why? What, you
get in the van.
You have no idea who you're dealing with.
So how will this play out? How will this work?
I'm so happy.
Make sure you're getting this.
This is another one that I had meant to see for years and have owned on DVD for, a while. I mean, whenever the Anchor Bay DVD came out, I feel like I didn't get it immediately, but one of my bosses at the time was like, you will love this, and loaned me her copy, and I've never returned it. I still have it. And this is like, I haven't worked at that company in 10 years. So it's been quite a while that I've had this copy, and I still hadn't watched it. So this was my first time watch for this. I think I'd seen parts of it, but never again the whole thing. Where do you land with this one? This seems like a Steph movie. This seems like something you would dig.
I guess I'm predictable, because you're right.
Not in a bad way.
I have a different experience than you. I got the Anchor Bay DVD pretty soon after it came out, and I watched it right away, and I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
I became a little obsessed with it. I would watch it, I think, like the first month I watched it like 3 times, and then I would watch it with the commentary or without it, like maybe once a month for like a couple of years.
Nice. Wow.
But that said, as obsessed as I was with it, I haven't seen it in at least 5 years before the Blu-ray came out. So I was really interested to see how it would hit me.
How did it hit you after that much time?
I still love it.
Yeah.
It's not quite as, I'm like old and bitter now, and I just don't enjoy anything as much as I used to.
Oh, boy.
No, but it's still wonderful. I still like it a lot. And I think when it comes to what we mentioned a little bit before with dark comedic horror, caught up to this movie a little bit. Because I think I think Behind the Mask was before its time.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that might have, it probably would have done a little bit better if it wasn't so unique. Like, I think Shaun of the Dead came out around the same time. You know, it wasn't the only one like it out there, but I think it was the one that really, I don't like to really use the word meta, but was one that like really kind of demanded that the more you know about horror, the more you're going to enjoy this. I feel like if you don't know like every trope, you could definitely get something out of it. But the more you know about horror, I think the more enjoyment you definitely get out of it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the people I know that are huge fans of this, I think Rob Galuzzo is a big one, and I know I've heard some others in the past. They're all really hardcore horror people. And I enjoyed this, although, I mean, I don't know what my thing is about smarmy, not smarmy, that's not right. That's not what this is. It's something else. It's that hyper clever, I guess, approach is almost distracting to me sometimes. And okay. but it's I think it's a thing where sometimes I'm just a little standoffish about this kind of character and the meta approach. Sometimes I'm fully on board with it, and sometimes I'm like, I don't know about you. I'm not sure. And then I'll come back to a movie and I'll sort of become more engaged by it, and it slowly grows on me. It's one of the rare types of movies that can have that effect on me, because you talked about old and embittered. I definitely, at this point where I'm at, if I see a movie and I don't like it, there's almost no chance that coming back to it 5, 6, 7, 8 years later that I will have changed my mind. It's just, I'm at a point now where, like, I like what I like and I don't like what I don't like, and, you know, never the twain shall meet. But this is the kind of movie where I liked it, but I feel like there'll be a point where I'll like it more, because I think I just got so, you know what I'm sure it is an ego thing, is probably what it is that I watch a movie and I'm trying to understand, like, how much this character, I mean, we haven't even talked about what it's about. The basic idea is that it's a faux documentary about a guy who is trying to be a serial killer / iconic horror figure along the lines of Jason and Freddy and Michael Myers. And this movie takes place in a universe where those characters are real people. And so it's kind of like an origin story, like, for, but I mean, it's not his first rodeo, but it's sort of that. But he goes through the whole process of, like, how he figures out, like, the girl that he's going to stalk and kill, and, like, little clues that he drops. And I think the part of it for me that threw me a little bit was I loved his meticulous nature and all the things that he was thinking about, all the prep he did. You know, I can't help but like a character. I think there's some stupid quote about a movie characters, in that if somebody is good at their job, you will like them. Even if they're, like, a horrible person, I think that works to a point, and I think it applies here. Like, because he is so dedicated and so passionate and obsessed with what he's doing, there's a part of me that can't help but be like, oh, that's pretty fucking cool. But there are things that he did and things that he was trying to set up that, at least for me, the first viewing, I was like, how do you know this was going to lead to this? And it feels like, you know what, another part of it is that in my job, there's a lot of overthinking. There's a lot of people who, you know, when we're trying to do something creative, they just come at it from way too much. I'm just like, let's strip this back and think about it on a much simpler level, and let's not overthink, because we're going to miss out on the best possible option because you're just too lost in your own head. And I'm not saying this movie is like that, but that's, I think, another thing for me is when I see overthinking, I think I have a pullback from that. But it all does, I think, make sense. I'm pretty sure it's a movie where if I come back to it, I'll be like, oh yeah, he was totally right. This totally makes sense. But for whatever reason, my stupid movie watching ego is kind of going like, this movie's starting to lose me a little bit because I don't fully understand how he's logicking out everything that he's doing. And so I'm pretty sure it's me and not the movie, you know? And that's why I know that when I come back to it, I'll like it more than I did. And again, I did like it this time. So I don't know. It's definitely a special movie. There's definitely something about it that made me go, yeah, there's something here, you know? And I think it's about me and not the movie. But like you said, it is definitely ahead of its time. And to compare it to Shaun of the Dead is apt in a lot of ways, because they came out really close together. They both have horror, they both have comedy, but, you know, in the end, they kind of become the movie they're parodying a little bit, at least in parts. This movie, more than Shaun of the Dead, I would say, becomes that movie. But yeah, it was really interesting to watch it. I thought it was really, I don't know, I'm very intrigued by the whole thing.
Yeah, they do a very interesting thing where they are filming a documentary and he's showing them, you know, you have to do cardio all the time to make it look like you're walking when everyone else is running, but you're still caught up to them. That's one of my favorite.
That is one of my favorite
bits. The humor too. And yeah. And he's showing him how he like sets the traps to make a door close. And all those are done on like a classic documentary camera. But when they show the scene from the victim's point of view, it changes. They use a different camera and aspect ratio, and suddenly it's a traditional film. And I think that was done incredibly well throughout the short scenes throughout the movie, especially the one in the library with Zelda Rubinstein. And this was actually cool. Her last movie.
And, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And Robert Englund, who is kind of like the Van Helsing of Leslie Vernon in this movie. And I just thought that contrast was so well done. But I have heard over the years, it gets a little divisive with the end scene. With the climax, it pretty much switches to the classic cinematic view 100%.
Yeah.
And I think that does lose some people. And I agree, like some of that personality, some of the quirkiness drains out of the film a little bit. It makes sense.
Totally.
With what they're building to.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does completely change the feel of the film.
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that I was, because it is so clever and so sharp, I think sometimes with movies like that, I have weird instincts about it where I was like, wait a minute, are you telling me that Jason and Freddy do research? Because I don't think those guys are fucking primal id motherfucking killers. Those guys don't research shit. They just kill people. So, like, it was an interesting juxtaposition of a guy trying to do, like, idolizing them. And in some way, in my head, it seemed like he was saying that they did do that. And in my head, I'm like, no, they definitely don't do that. But I get why you're doing it. They're superheroes. They're super killers.
And right. You're they're just like the aim. And he's trying to figure it out and deconstruct
totally.
It.
Totally. And I think that's a part where I was like, in my head, I was like, wait, they're creating this cool. But you know, the other thing that I love about it is the scenes with Scott Wilson.
Yes.
I'm not talking about the guys that really worked hard. Like Jay, Fred, Mike, there weren't nobody like them in the early years. We just hit hard, wiped everybody out, and disappeared as soon as we could without ever giving a thought to coming back. Those boys lifted it to a whole other level. They made an art form of it, turned themselves into legends by returning like a curse over and over again. That was a radical change in philosophy. Changed the whole business.
The business of supernatural killing sprees.
She's not exactly on board yet with the whole why we do what we do thing.
No, young lady, about the business of fear. Every culture, every civilization from the dawn of man has had its monsters. For good to be pitted against evil, you have to have evil, don't you?
That's some of my favorite stuff. Is because Scott Wilson plays like a retired serial killer who is a good friend with the Leslie Vernon character. And by the way, Nathan Basil, I guess, who plays Leslie Vernon, I think he's very good. I think
he's fantastic. He's very natural.
He really sells it. Yeah. Really sells
it. Yeah, and he's good looking without being like the alienating like movie star looking. Like he's totally a regular guy. Good looking. I think that helps sells it a lot.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. There's a lot of he's really well cast, and the movie definitely doesn't work as well if it isn't this actor. I don't know. I think that's a big deal. But the Scott Wilson stuff is great because he's sort of his mentor in a way. And I'm definitely going to include some clips of Scott Wilson talking about like his career. And at one point, the Taylor character who's doing the documentary like asks him like what someone can do to like get away. And he's just like,
the simple answer is run like a motherfucker and don't stop till the sun comes up. Pardon the French, but there it is. And don't try to hide. We'll find you. Don't try to be a hero and fight us. You'll lose. Now pick out a clear spot ahead of you, as far away as possible, and run. Straight. And don't ever, ever look back. Because you won't like what you see. I promise you that.
How about sticking together?
Well, sure. Sure, you can do that.
Just make sure there's one poor son of a bitch slower than you when it comes time to run.
I was fast, wasn't I, Eugene?
You sure were. But yeah. You caught me, didn't you?
I did.
Okay.
It's more like, it's just really like, I don't know if you're going to get away. Kind of, you know, this. It was just really well. He really helped sell the mythology of the world, which is the thing that I really liked about the movie. Just creating this idea of this underground network of killers who are, you know, aware of each other and aware of the ones that aren't as clever and that fuck up and get themselves caught by the cops and those fucking hacks and, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. I thought that was really neat. So
it was. He has a beautiful wife. He lives in a nice home and they're just talking shop.
Well, what was the deal with his wife? Was it that he was trying to get her but didn't? Or was that just a joke?
Yeah,
like,
I think she was the one who literally got away but stayed because she got away.
It was just a great throwaway line where she's like, she said something about not getting away or getting away. And then I don't remember, but I was just like, wait, what? Oh, okay. All right. That's cool.
And I never caught it all the times I watched it before. But there's this little scene where they kind of hint that he might have been the toolbox murderer.
Oh, I missed that. That's cool.
Yeah. Oh, and this thing, if you're annoyed by references to other horror movies, this will drive you crazy.
Oh, for sure.
But if you get a kick out scene like Kane Hodder and
that
people
was a great
from
cameo.
The Nightmare on Elm Street house, and like his turtles are named from Pet Sematary, Church and Zoe. Like,
oh, nice.
If you dig that kind of thing.
Well, and I noticed that there's a point where he's like putting on some makeup, and in the background, you can hear the song from The Shining is playing, the like midnight. Oh, fuck. What is that song called? I forget. But it's the one that plays like at the end when you see the picture of Jack Nicholson, that super creepy old song. It's just in the background playing, you know.
No, Scott Glosserman, the director, and everything, commentaries, documentary, he's obsessed with The Shining.
Nice. Not surprised.
Oh, I'm sorry to go back to Full Moon High, but on the commentary for it, when he goes to a graveyard, Larry Cohen's just like, another scene is from Carrie, De Palma. I liked it when that hand came up, so I put that in here. We always find a theme.
That's hilarious.
We always find connective tissue.
Stephen King, man. No, it's hilarious too, because it's like a total, you know, throwaway gag in Full Moon High that his dad reaches up from the grave and like tries to grab his hand and then he shakes it off and he's gone. It's just fucking so silly. But anyway, tell me about this is one where I got to watch a little bit of the making of.
Essentially what has happened is that now that I'm here in Portland and I've had the opportunity to go to the sets and to some of the locations where we're actually going to be shooting, it's become apparent because of budget constraints that we need to rewrite the script to fit the sets and the locations, not vice versa. We can't build a town, we can't create a barn silo, you know, things like that. So the script needs to be rewritten to fit what we have available to shoot, what they have available to shoot with. So that's been the bulk of my job up here this week. Hear so many people up here working so hard and so dedicated to this script, and hear that many voices talking about stuff that I wrote, it's blowing my mind. They're all talking about it in the most logistical, concrete terms, like, well, this is how we need to do this, and then Taylor's gonna have to do this, and talking about characters like real people and plot points, like, you know, it's not this abstract concept anymore. It's how are we gonna are they going to run from the house to the barn, and how are we going to hang this kid? And it's just, that's just so just bizarre and surreal.
This has a lot of special features. Some of them are ported over from the DVD, but there's some new stuff here. And how familiar with you? You said you watched with the commentary and all these other things. What do you like? What are some of your favorite older special features, and what did you like from the new stuff, if you can say?
Okay, I'm glad they brought over the really good stuff from the DVD, the making of, and the little casting thing, and the commentary with the actors are all from the Anchor Bay DVD.
Cool.
And they did a new commentary with, and from the references they made, they filmed it really, or recorded it really recently with Joe Lynch and Adam Green,
cool,
with the director, which I didn't fully understand. But they just said they're super fans, and but they're very enthusiastic, and they talk quite a bit about their own projects.
Well, that's what they always do.
I know. Well, just
especially
recently.
Adam Green. No offense to Adam Green fans, but I had to take a break from the Movie Crypt because I was a big fan of that show for a while. I'm just being completely honest here, because I just couldn't handle the 10-15 minutes of my projects at the front of every single episode. I just burnt out on it. So
yeah, for people who feel that way, they'll probably want to skip it. I actually listened to their commentary on Friday the 13th Part 4 recently, because we just had Friday the 13th, and I was surprised how similar the commentaries for both of them were. And really? There is a lot of talking over Scott Glosserman trying to tell stories. There's a lot of interrupting.
Oh, so, that drives me crazy.
Yeah, you might want to skip that commentary.
That's too bad, because the thing is that they seem like nice dudes and guys who are very passionate and, respect their fan bases and appreciate them. But I think they just get a little overly enthusiastic and have become less aware of how much they talk about themselves and their stuff. But it's really, I think it comes from a slightly unaware place of enthusiasm. I don't think it's malicious.
I agree. And there's a new, at first I thought it was at a convention, but they actually filmed it at Dark Delicacies in Burbank,
nice,
which is an amazing horror-centric bookstore for anyone who's visiting Burbank. Go to Dark Delicacies. And they interviewed pretty much everyone involved except for Leslie Vernon himself. He wasn't there, unfortunately.
I don't know.
But everyone had great memories of it. Everyone was still incredibly proud to be a part of it. So there were talking heads interviews. But if you're a fan of the movie, it's cool to see what everyone is up to and that everyone is still fond of it.
Nice. Yeah. What I saw of the, I guess it's like his diary, or it's like video diary of filming stuff. Yeah, it was interesting just to kind of get a like day by day, production kind of overview. I guess I'm sure the commentary has a little bit more, and I didn't get to that, but I wanted to hear more about, like, I always want to hear more about influences and, like, this is from that. I mean, he's clearly wearing a ton of that on his sleeve, and that the movie is so meta, but part of me wants to get inside the head of somebody like that. And so I really need to listen to that commentary.
Yeah, maybe I'll edit it for you when he talks about, okay, they're wearing yellow in this scene because people wore yellow in The Shining before they died. So I had them wear yellow.
That's
in this
crazy.
Before he gets interrupted again.
That's
so if
cool.
You want to know about influences, The Shining is number one.
Number one. Well, I mean, it's a great movie. I get why he'd be so influenced by it. You know what I didn't see in the movie, and I don't think it was in the deleted scenes, but I wanted a scene where he explained how he picked his mask. Is that somewhere, or is it not?
I don't think so.
Because I love the mask, and I think it's super creepy and weird. It's like kind of like a baby's face with like really deeply sunken eyes and this weird crazy bits of hair on it. It's a really well, like, because that's one of my favorite things in horror movies is when you can get a good mask.
Yes. Oh boy, that
goes
gets
a long
you a
way.
Lot of mileage.
Right? Yeah, it goes a long way.
And Vinegar Syndrome just released Star Time, and I was watching it before the Blu-ray came out. I was like, that's a Leslie Vernon mask right there.
Totally. That. Yeah, that's the predecessor. It's very much a similar kind of mask. Yeah. God, I just was looking at that Blu-ray today. That's so funny.
But I do love the scene where they show him applying the makeup underneath, because there's so many masks where they're clearly wearing eyeliner underneath, but they don't address it. So you just imagine this monster like standing in front of the mirror, just like applying his makeup. But they show him like blacking out all the holes under the mask. And I appreciated that.
No, I did too. I like that too. Yeah. No, you're right. It's so funny because now I'm thinking of like specifically Jason Lives like when the eyes open, you know, you can clearly see that it, I mean, maybe you could say that it's supposed to be like rotted flesh, but it looks like, you know, blacked eyeballs and eyelids and stuff. So that is funny. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, this is a really sharp movie. And like I said, one that clearly has something special about it that I totally responded to and that I know I will enjoy more the more I watch it. And the more I dig through these features. So I'm psyched that it's a perfect fit for Scream Factory. I mean, it's
definitely,
you know what I mean? Like, and it's become a cult item, like, because of it being ahead of its time. So I'm hoping that this Blu-ray will help a lot of people discover it. Because I know in the horror community, it's definitely talked about a lot. But I mean, I knew of it and I hadn't watched it, you know, so I'm sure that there are a ton of people that haven't seen it. And in this age of like Tragedy Girls and Final Girls and things like that, it fits right in. It's just a perfect, you know, companion piece to those. I mean, it's even like dialed back a tiny bit from where those movies are at. So I feel like it really works.
Yeah, this isn't like a full out horror comedy or anything. It has a sense of humor. But it's played pretty straight, and it's definitely a love letter to the genre, but it stands on its own, in my opinion, completely. And there are moments that are really tension filled. Like when they get into the horror, they take it seriously.
Yeah, they do. And what's great about it is that, I don't want to spoil the ending, but basically the whole movie is jokingly setting up this guy who is a killer, and that is what his deal is. And so there's a point in the movie where he's gonna start doing that, and that is it's a weird tension to go from this sort of jovial hanging out watching him in his process kind of laughing to like, oh shit, yeah, that's right, he's gonna kill people for real. And so that's like a weird tonal thing that I think they pull off. But
they
it's
really
still
sell it.
Yeah, they really do, but it still feels a little weird, and not in a bad way, but just in a way that there just aren't too many movies like this that can pull this off, you know.
But that's why I really liked Angela Gothels, who plays the lead, Taylor. She's the main documentarian.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie was blessed. Like, all the people that came together to make this film were just at the top of their game, and Robert Englund is He's incredible. I mean, he's such an icon, you know, in the horror genre, but just in general. I you know, I of course knew who he was, and actually, he told me later, after we were already in production, that he had seen me in a play that I did in New York, an off-Broadway play when I was 12 years old, and he remembered it. He and his wife saw it and loved it and remembered it, and when he found out that I was attached to this movie, he was excited, even more so than he had been, which was tremendously flattering. But he's just, I mean, he's incredible. The things that he knows, the little nuances and the lessons that he was able to share, you know, just of the mechanics of making a horror movie and the specifics of, like, you know, how do you fall when you've been stabbed in the neck, or, like, you know, just like things that the average person, you know, doesn't really know, you know, and how to sort of conserve your energy when you're in, you know, in your killing spree, when you're like really in that zone, you know, take after take, like how do you conserve, and he's just, and he's so cool. He's just cool to be around, very generous.
And she's just charmed by him the whole time. Like, she knows who she's interviewing, but she's clearly charmed by him. And then when it hits that point, he's like, okay, well, I've been working on putting this all into gear. She's like heartbroken, almost like, seriously, you're actually gonna kill teenagers? Like, you can't do this, are you serious? He's like, you knew who I was.
And you see his point of view and
emotional.
Hers
absolutely.
It totally works. That could be a place where the movie really stumbles. So yeah, I gotta give hats off to Scott Glosserman for pulling off, because I guess I feel like the other thing that maybe I'm reacting to, if I'm really thinking about it, is that I've seen so many, you know, quote unquote, clever horror movies, you know, like somebody who was obviously just a big fan of horror movies and was like, I can write one, and my characters will be self-aware, and, you know, won't that be clever?
They live on John Carpenter Street.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So, like, I mean, clearly there's a lot of love for horror movies in general. There's a lot of great people who love horror movies. And then there are a lot of people who are creative who love horror movies and are able to channel that energy in a great way. And then there are some that are just not meant to be filmmakers or are just not able, they've seen enough of a certain thing, they think they can imitate it. But then you realize it's much more complicated than that. And that's, I think, like I said, this is another movie where when I think about it, the more I think about it, the more I respect how much he actually accomplishes and how much he pulls off tonally and otherwise that so many movies I've seen have tried to do and have totally not been able to do it. So I think there's another part of me that's like, is he really pulling this off? I don't know, you know, because I'm in the midst of it and I can't... So I'm analyzing it subconsciously in the back of my head as like one of those movies, and which is not fair to the movie, but it's just, you know, one of those things you get to a point where
I can absolutely see where you're coming from. You know what I mean? But I am a champion for it. This is a first time movie on a micro budget.
It's crazy.
The cast, their chemistry is incredible. It's just really ambitious.
Totally.
If you think about it.
No, it's remarkable.
So many things could go wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I do feel like each movie should be taken on its own merit. But first movie, like, and in a genre that sometimes it feels like everything's been done. So yeah. When something comes out where you don't get that feeling at all, it reminds me, as a really big horror fan, why I put up with so much crap is because when those gems come out, nothing, in my opinion, to me, nothing feels better.
No,
like,
you're
nothing
right.
Is more fun to watch.
Yeah, I 100%, as much as I, you know, my reaction was slightly mixed, but generally positive, the more we talk about it, the more I think about it, the more I appreciate everything that he has pulled off here, and the more I can't recommend enough that people seek this movie out if they haven't already, you know, done so. Like I said, I feel like a lot of people talk about it, people are aware of it, but I feel like there's definitely a faction of horror folks that have not seen it, partially because it came out in 2006 and we're more than a decade past that. And it's never been on Blu-ray, you know, since that time. So
I think it was on a bare bones.
Oh,
Blu-ray.
My bad. So regardless, I still feel like if you missed it in 2006, and a lot of people did, that's the downside too, to it being your first film, is that there's no hype machine around you or anything. The movie has to do everything on its own. And it's really hard for movies to connect to people, you know, so many factors, you know.
That's funny. In the commentary, it came up Cabin Fever. And they're like, well, what'd you think, like, Cabin Fever and how everyone went crazy over that? It's like, yeah, Cabin Fever got a lot of support.
And then
you're like, oh man, like Leslie Vernon should have gotten that support too.
Yeah, no, it's when you think about it that way, then I get a little bit angry, because then I'm like, well, this is a better fucking movie than Cabin Fever for sure. You know, and it's sad. I guess the more I do this show, the more I do Pure Cinema, the more I'm sort of looking back at certain movies, especially through the lens of what's coming out on home video, the more I'm like realizing so many things get left behind. So many things don't find an audience until years later. And, you know, even recently I was hearing, I can't remember what, maybe it was on F This Movie or somewhere, where they were talking about like how Fred Decker doesn't even like to talk about Monster Squad anymore, because it's great that people have found it now, but it's just this badge of failure for him, you know, and this whole idea of like, yeah, it just didn't do anything for me now, you know, and that's sad to me, but I get it from his point of view. It's,
yeah, even John Carpenter has said that sometimes. He's like, where was everyone back then?
Yeah, which is, I get that as well. You know, I mean, the guy's career takes a different turn. That's, especially having just done the Carpenter, you know, episodes for Pure Cinema, that was very much in my head the whole time, was like, man, how did this affect, you know, what happened? And that's John Carpenter, you know, and he made some of the greatest movies ever. And so you just think about a little movie like this, and the fact that anybody remembers it at all is really a testament to how interesting it is. So anyway, I don't mean to go on and on, but I'm with you, and I'm glad you recommend it. It's definitely a blind buy worthy movie, and if you're working on a horror script and you want some inspiration, or you want to see somebody that has figured out something really interesting, this is your movie. This is the one.
Yeah, and they even had to do some rewriting while they were filming based on their budget limitations, and you don't really feel or see that. I didn't know that until they said it. So yeah, I think definitely horror filmmakers are getting started. This is, I would go as far as say it's essential.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely one of those, looking at basically what's included here, the new stuff and the old stuff, I feel like it's kind of one of those like film school in a box experiences that you can really get a lot out of if you're thinking of becoming a filmmaker, or if you're already a filmmaker. There's got to be something in here that will help you, you know, I would think. So you've totally pulled out any doubt I had about this movie through this conversation. So I appreciate you talking me into how much I think I actually do enjoy this film. So anyway, that will do it, I think, for this episode. Stephanie, thank you so much once again for coming back and talking movies with me. I love it.
Thank you for having me. It's fun.
It is absolutely my pleasure. And I am always working on new stuff we can talk about. So I have to find next month's equivalent to Full Moon High.
You literally messaged me saying, now I'm trying to figure out what to pair with Full Moon High. And I'm just sitting there. I'm like, we're doing Full Moon High? When did that happen?
I feel like that came up on the Rockula episode. Maybe not. Maybe I'm just in my head it came up.
Yeah. And I think talking about Joanne Neal.
Yes. That was it. It was the connecting. So that was, it was just a thing where it had to happen. So I got to find the next Rockula / Full Moon High / Rappin'. I was like, yeah, why can't I think of it? Oh, it's totally different than the other two.
No, you have Classy Elric, and then you call in me for rapping werewolves and vampires. I get it.
we put up a good front. We put up a good front, but there's lots of talk about not so classy movies behind the scenes, and you know, on my Twitter feed all the time. Sometimes I wonder, like, sometimes I think about it as a balance. Like, I'm like, okay, I've talked about a little too much about shitty movies today. Maybe I should throw in a couple classy movies that I like. And at a point, I lose track of how much of one or the other I've done. And now I'm pretty sure that I'm well weighted on the side of shitty movies versus classy movies. And I'm fine with that.
So I guess I'll see you in a few years then. I filled my quota. Good night, everyone.
No, we got to do our art house episode. We got to do something. I'm trying to think, like The Passenger, or I'm definitely going to do The Passenger soon. Anyway, I don't need to think out loud on the show. I should let you get to sleep. But I'm always working on ideas, Stephanie. That's the bottom line. Is I need your talents on my show, and so I'm always thinking of ways to involve you, and I do appreciate you being down.
Well, I appreciate being thought of and included. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you all for listening. Have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.